I hope you're having a wonderful Sunday. I know I am. I'm here in the beautiful studio, WGN, overlooking the Chicago River. And I hope you're listening in to a show dedicated to the law. I was recently on a podcast called Gold Shields, where I met two hosts who I really was amazed by their careers and their knowledge and their experience. Dan Murphy and Tom Smith, they're two retired New York City detectives who host a very popular podcast, and they brings to their listeners stories about true crimes, policing, the criminal justice system, etc. And today we have in studio Dan Murphy, who is joining me and is going to talk cops. Hi, Dan. How are you?
I'm great, Karen. Thank you so much for having me here.
Now, Dan talks funny. Okay, so we just have to just agree that he does talk funny, and I don't. I have a Chicago accent, which is a normal accent. Yours, not so much, Dan. Just give me some
I will
some
try
grief.
To homogenize my accent if I can. Yeah,
I think that ship has sailed a long time ago. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about your career? Because it has some ups and downs and some interesting twists, and if you could just kind of explain where you were and what you've done.
Sure. I was 21 years old when I joined the NYPD. I was a kid that grew up in Queens and probably didn't know any better, but it was fun at the time. New York City in the 80s and 90s was completely out of control. Crime was through the roof. Being a cop was an adrenaline rush every night. I worked in very busy areas. And then I became a detective after working in the narcotics division, which at the time was just a zoo. So much drugs. Crack was causing crime to go through the roof. So much violence, so much craziness. But for us, it was fun because every night was exciting. And then I made detective, and then I ended up being in the major case squad, which was very interesting. I worked in a task force with the Drug Enforcement Administration, which I had my introduction to federal racketeering cases, which were fascinating. And I did them for almost 7 years, including one that took me with the DEA agent to Hong Kong, where I did an undercover operation, which to this day I still can't believe I did it. It was kind of ridiculously dangerous, but that's the kind of detective I was. If there was an objective, we were going to go after it. And then I became a major case squad detective, which is the highest profile cases in a department, the kidnappings for ransom, the murders of police officers, things that chief of detectives tell you are top priority. And then became a sergeant. I ended up in the terrorism task force after 9/11. I worked gangs. I was very, very blessed in my career. I worked with amazing people. I saw everything. I met everything from presidents down to the lowest of the low on the street. And I wouldn't trade it for the world, but it's a young man's game, and I'm glad I'm out of it.
Yeah, absolutely. We were just talking about it, and I was whining a little bit about being a lawyer and how you're always involved with people's problems. And if you care, it really is hard on you because you really want to make a difference. And I realized that I was whining on the yacht. You know, when I'm looking at you, who spent all these years doing the same thing, but with a bulletproof vest and with your life on the line every day. So thank you for your service. I want to say that before we say anything else. So you were in the police department when 9/11 happened. Can you describe for our listeners what that was like as a person in New York City and also as as a police officer?
Sure. When I was a kid, I watched the World Trade Centers being built. From my perch in Western Queens, where I grew up, we could see the buildings clearly. My neighborhood was very blue collar. Everybody was a construction trade worker or a civil servant for the most part. And a lot of my neighborhood worked on it. And I distinctly remember it being such a big employer. And those buildings went up, and watching them come down was heartbreaking. 9/11 is actually my birthday, so I wasn't...
Oh, my goodness.
I wasn't in that day with my unit. At the time, I was a sergeant supervising a citywide detective investigative unit. Technical unit. And I made my way in, of course, because once you see that happening, it's all hands on deck. And it changed the trajectory of the city and my life permanently, because there's no going back from seeing and experience the things that I did and many others did that day and in the weeks and months and years afterwards.
As a police officer, did you, not that you ever expect something like that to happen, but, you know, being on the ground and knowing that there was terrorism at the time, were you less surprised by something like this because you were aware that these kinds of things could happen?
Well, certainly the 1993 bombing was an indication that America is not immune. These things can happen anywhere, and it did happen in 93. And I don't think anyone who paid attention to the news or to the chatter, so to speak, would tell you that they were shocked that they came back to do this. The nature of that specific group, Al-Qaeda, was they were very clear about their intentions. They said publicly in Al Jazeera and other avenues that they were going to come back and finish the job, and they did.
Now, I'd like your input on this, because I keep hearing that, you know, crime's terrible, and you turn on the television, that's all you see. But, you know, we all know that if it bleeds, it leads, and that, it might be have a magnifying glass on it more than it should. It is still a problem, not to say it's not a problem. But statistics, crime statistics are down from what I see in the FBI reports. Homicides are down, violent crimes are down, and even property crimes are down, maybe except for the retail thefts that we're seeing. Is that what you know? And if that's the case, then why does everyone really kind of have the idea that crime is through the roof?
You know, crime is not a number thing. It's a perception thing, right? If you walk down the street and you don't feel comfortable, then you're not. And so there might be a reason why. When you talk about homicides, it's probably the best indicator of the health of a city is the homicide rate, at least through the eyes of cops. We tend to look at it as if you have a high homicide rate, you're in a bad city. In New York City, we had so many homicides in the late 80s and early 90s, 2,400 a year, that now, even though the crime rates in New York have gone up and they seem to be leveling off, even if you have 500 or 600 homicides a year in New York, that's a lot for current standards, but it's nothing compared to what I used to see. And there's also a lot of reasons for that. Some of the drivers could be medical advances in trauma techniques. Believe it or not, a lot of people get saved or lost in the ambulance or in the ER. And if more advances are made and better medical practices happen, less people die. And it affects the statistics. Does it affect the way people feel on the street? Not necessarily.
Interesting. We're going to take a break in just about 2 minutes. But, you know, being a police officer and you've had all this experience, what are the things that you think that cities like Chicago and New York can and should be doing to bring this down, to prevent crime, to do the right thing, to make the city safer?
Well, I saw it firsthand. I lived it in 1993, 94, and through the 90s. You take a city that has the perception of being out of control with crime, and you have to have a team effort. The district attorney's office has to be on board. They have to prosecute. They have to fight for bail. You can't let people walk out the door with bail. Jack Maple, who was the deputy commissioner of crime control strategies and a brilliant strategist with crime in the 90s in New York City, famously said, "It's not about crime, it's criminals." So in any city, you have a hardcore group of career criminals who are committing crimes that are responsible for the vast majority of criminal reports. If you target them, if you go after them for their vulnerabilities, their Achilles heels, who's on parole, who has a warrant, if you fight to get high bail for these folks once they're arrested, you can make a dent in crime. We did it in New York. That, in addition to quality of life crimes. Go after the little stuff, because the little stuff is indicative of the bigger stuff.
And then one of the things in Chicago that we're seeing is that they're not going after the quote little stuff, which are, you know, these crews, you've seen them coming into the Gucci stores, mm-hmm. and smashing their cars right through the window and just taking everything they can. And, you know, the retail people are told not to stand down, and they don't want anyone to get hurt. And they just, that doesn't seem to be, ramification for these types of things.
Well, when somebody knows that they're not going to be held with bail, when someone knows that a district attorney in a certain city or a municipality has decided they are not going to prosecute property crimes, or they're not going to prosecute low-level drug offenses or quality of life offenses, there's absolutely nothing to stop them from doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. We're here talking to Dan Murphy. He is a podcaster with Gold Shields. Can you just tell our listeners briefly how to listen? This is a great podcast. Like, there are a lot of podcasts. What is it? The phrase that it's like having children and having a podcast. You know, everyone can have one, but some people shouldn't. but this is a good one. Of all the podcasts, I think I've done like 70-something podcasts in the last 3 months promoting my book. And yours was one of my favorites, because you guys are real intelligent and you're real down to earth, and we had a great conversation. How can people listen in?
Well, thank you for saying that, Karen. We appreciate that. You can listen on any one of the various platforms that are out there with podcasts, the Buzzsprouts, the Apples, the Audibles. We're on virtually everything, as well as YouTube and Rumble if you want to see our smiling faces. Although I've been told for years I have a face for radio, so if you've just eaten, you might not want to watch.
When we come back, let's talk about this really interesting case of the Uvalde former police chief who was indicted and charged with child endangerment last week. This is going to be very, very interesting. You're listening to WGN. We're here talking to Dan Murphy. He's a retired detective sergeant from the NYPD and host of a podcast called Gold Shields. And for our 60626 texter, Gold Shields, that's the name of the podcast. Thank you for asking. Last week, the former police chief of Uvalde, Texas, was charged for child endangerment and criminal negligence in the school shooting down there that left 19 children and two teachers dead. And the news reports it's the first prosecution of its kind. Did you see this, Dan?
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of it? What was your first reaction?
Well, first of all, the Uvalde situation, the shooting that took place down there, I watched the police response. I've seen the videos multiple times, and I was embarrassed for the profession. This is because we've come a long way in how police view active shooter situations, and there is a protocol, there's a response that is trained, and they didn't follow it. And as a result of that, people died. And this specific chief, who was the chief of the Uvalde, Texas Police Department, a shooting in Uvalde, he came out and made statements to the effect of he didn't feel he was the officer in charge. I was shocked. I thought there was very poor leadership that day. I thought that all the protocols and things that had been set up, the incident command center establishment, all the communication protocols, all the best practices were not adhered to.
Can you just get a little bit more specific with and use terms that we can understand? Because just very basically, what didn't they do? What did they do? What should they have done?
Here's how cops are trained for active shooter events. Make a beeline for the shooter, neutralize the shooter, period. You step over people that are shot and wounded. You run around what you have to run around. You go through what you have to go through, but you neutralize the shooter. That's what you're paid for. That's what you're trained for. That's what you're issued weapons for. Bulletproof vests, radios, backup, all of it is for that purpose. Not to stand in the hallway and look for somebody else to tell you what to do. And I watched what happened that day, and it really, really got under my skin. And the more I watched the videos, the more it dawned on me that it was because of a failure of leadership. Now, people died as a result of inaction. It's unacceptable.
Now, I don't know about exactly what happened here, but as a police officer, let's just say you know that, and that's how you were trained, to go and do that beeline, as you say. Mm-hmm. And you're standing there, and what if your superior is saying, no, don't do anything. Don't breach the door. Don't do this. I mean, what do you do? Do you listen to your boss and then risk being not only sued, but being prosecuted?
You know, there's such a thing as a lawful order and a non-lawful order. To not live up to your oath to protect the innocents, when you're given an order that's in conflict with that, I would say go with what you know you're supposed to do. I didn't swear an oath to that chief. I swore an oath to my department and my city and my state and to the people of my community, not to him. That day, any direction he gave that was in conflict with what was directly needed to be done, I think should have been ignored. And I don't want a Monday morning quarterback, and it sounds like I am. But I have enough experience to say that I don't know anybody that I've ever worked with back in New York who would not have kicked that door in and done what they had to do.
A new law in Illinois is going to make it mandatory for police to wear body cameras. It's sort of a gradual law that in a certain number of years, we will all have all police departments will be wearing body cameras. Is this a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's a good thing. You know, initially when the idea or the concept of body cameras came up, I think police unions nationally were against it. And I don't know why. Because if you trust your people to do the right thing, wouldn't you want that documented? There's nothing worse than being falsely accused, whether you're a suspect on the street or a police officer. And false accusations happen against police all the time. What better way to get out of a ticket or a better way to get out of a misdemeanor arrest or something than to say the officer yelled at me, called me this, did that? I think that these body cams have vindicated far more than they have indicted officers in their daily use of them. So I think it's good. The public needs to know the truth about interactions. And I think many times stories will come out and the body cam immediately refutes it. But if an officer is acting in an illegitimate, illegal way, the public needs to know that too.
I agree with you on that. And I think we're seeing a lot of that. We're seeing we have a lot of shootings in Chicago. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of police involvement. And in some mm-hmm. of these cases, it might sound bad and then we get the video and we see what really happened when mm-hmm. someone is shooting a police officer at close range, and, you know, and then what happens happens. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about a new tool for the police that could replace pepper spray and your involvement with this product.
Sure. A couple of years ago, in 2020, there was no secret that there was riots all across the country. This, of course, in reaction to the George Floyd situation in Minneapolis, and a lot of things happened that were captured on camera that I watched, where police officers were using antiquated tools, tools that were not necessarily optically friendly, or were not necessarily accepted by the general public. Pepper spray, tear gas, things that were impacting far more than an intended target. So a lot of people were getting hurt by these things. Rubber bullets. I've seen all kinds of things that are just not acceptable in 2024 America. This caused me to work with a chemist, and I determined, Tom Smith and I, my partner on the podcast, we decided, let's try to see if there's something better that we can do. You know, pepper spray is kind of a stagnant tool, a stagnant industry, to the extent that cops don't really use it. They don't like to use it. There's a lot of mess involved. If I spray you with it, now we're in a room right now in a studio. If I spray you, I have to leave this room, and you should get out of it too, because the whole room is not the place you want to be. It takes a long time to clean up afterwards. It causes respiratory distress. I don't have to tell you that no police officer wants somebody in their custody who's screaming that they can't breathe. It's an unnecessary yes. element of taking somebody into custody or getting compliance. So we came up with something working with a chemist. We call it Impact. It is not pepper spray. It is not tear gas. It's a safer blend of chemicals and water that cleans up very quickly, that does what it needs to do without doing what it doesn't need to do, doesn't cause that respiratory distress. It tags you with a UV marking dye, so later on, if you escape, I can identify you positively. We tried to think about what the problems and the downsides were, and we tried to remove them. And we're currently getting some traction with law enforcement, private security firms. We've only been to market a short period of time, and we're going to be traveling all over the country doing demonstrations. We have a bunch of them lined up.
So it still hurts when you shoot me with that. I'm going to feel it.
I've been hit 8 times with the Karen, and it's miserable.
But your wife shouldn't be doing that.
Well, she did. She did.
Tell her to stop.
You know, I love you, Angela, but she hit me with an entire can of it. I told her a 3-second burst, and she hit me with an entire can of it. And wow, it's very painful to the eyes, but it cleans up with a little bit of water. Almost immediately, you feel better.
Interesting. And so, what I'm kind of interested in is the tagging of it. So, mm-hmm. Tell me. So. You shoot me and I run away, right? And I've got this stuff on me, and maybe I don't know I have this stuff on me still. I wash it off. But then you bring me in and I say I wasn't there, and you can actually shine something on me and
a UV flashlight, shine it over your face or wherever you were hit, including your clothes, and it's going to show up very clearly. That's a positive identification. That, because I think the world can agree, if you understand the nature of eyewitness testimony, that people who are victims of crime often don't make the proper identification because they're scared, they look at the wrong thing. This is one of those corroborating factors that can help positively say, this is the guy that did A, B, or C to me.
And you could also sell this to people like who just want to have that in their purse, you know,
yes.
just to be... And because it's safer for the user.
Yes. Now, if you have pepper spray in your purse or in your car and you try to use it in an elevator, that's a mistake. You're going to be under the influence of it as well. Our stuff you can use anywhere. You can use it sharing an Uber ride with somebody and you'll be fine.
Tell us a little bit about your podcast, Gold Shields, and I will plug it right now because it's really one of the best podcasts out there. It's got a variety of different elements to it, but please tell us, like, what is your goal in this podcast, and what kind of guests do you get on?
We had no idea exactly what we were going to do when we started. We knew true crime, but we try to bring on the people who made cases, the detectives, sometimes the investigative journalists, sometimes the family members of a victim. We will bring on certain military operators. It's all about great stories. We want to show what it's like behind the newspaper headlines. What is it like to work 72 hours without sleeping on a kidnapping case? What is it like to sit across from Jeffrey Dahmer and interview him? What sort of feelings do you go through as you're dealing with cases involving children? We want to give you a backstage pass to what people go through when they do that sort of work.